So before we jump into things today, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
Highly recommend them.
Yeah, they've got this full Series 3 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are actually weighted just like the real thing.
Which is huge.
It's massive.
Right.
So check it out at certfuel.com. Because today, our mission is very, very specific, and honestly, the stakes could not be higher. We are mastering options premiums for the Series 3 exam.
Yeah, and we really need to anchor just how critical this specific mountain of information is for you as you're studying for the Series 3.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, the National Futures Association, the NFA, they keep their exact algorithmic weighting for the test pretty close to the chest, you know?
Right, it's a total secret.
Exactly. But anyone who has been through this gauntlet knows that part one of the exam spans chapters 1 through 7, and combined, that makes up roughly 71% of your entire exam score.
Wait, 71%.
71%.
That is insane. That is literally the definition of a make or break concept.
It really is.
Yeah.
And the concept of options premiums, it isn't just isolated to one chapter. It bleeds into hedging, it bleeds into speculation, margin requirements.
So you can't just skip it and hope for the best.
No, absolutely not. You cannot hide from options premiums. They are basically the water you are swimming in.
Okay, so 71%.
Yeah.
If you don't understand premiums, you don't pass. Period. But I mean, here is the silver lining, right? The thing that actually makes this whole mess manageable.
There is a silver lining, yeah.
Because this entire sprawling universe
Yeah.
of options pricing,
Yeah.
all the, complex derivatives and Greeks and market maker models, it all fundamentally rests on one single solitary equation.
Just one.
Right. And
Yeah.
we can get you to internalize this one equation today. Everything else we talk about is just like a variation on a theme.
Yeah, that is the core identity of this entire unit. If you just strip away all the financial jargon, every single option premium in existence, whether it's on a crude oil future, a treasury bond, or I don't know, a massive stock index,
Yeah.
it breaks down into exactly two components. Premium equals intrinsic value plus time value.
Premium equals intrinsic value plus time value.
That is the DNA.
Okay, but memorizing a formula is one thing, right? Like, I can write premium equals IV plus TV on a flashcard all day.
Sure.
But I have ADHD, so I need to like feel what that actually represents in the real world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, under the stress of the Prometric Testing Center, those letters are just going to completely scramble in my head.
Oh, absolutely. The pressure does weird things to your memory.
It really does.
Yeah.
So I always picture this concept like trying to buy a premium concert ticket on the secondary market.
Okay, I like this.
Think about an absolute stadium tour juggernaut, right?
Huh.
We were talking Taylor Swift, Beyonce, the kind of ticket that just flat out crashes the internet.
The impossible tickets.
Exactly. The show is totally sold out.
Yeah.
You're desperate to go, so you log on to a resale site. You find a ticket, lower bowl, great view, and the price is just eye-watering. The scalper wants $1,000.
Which is sadly a completely standard reality for live entertainment right now.
Right. So you pay the $1,000, you get the physical cardboard ticket mailed to you, and you look closely at the fine print at the bottom. Printed right there, established by the venue on the day the tour was announced, the actual face value of the seat is only $200.
Okay, so that $200, that is the intrinsic value.
Yes. It is the literal, concrete, established worth of the seat itself right now. It is the baseline reality of what you are holding in your hand.
Which leaves a massive gap. Because if the concrete reality is $200, where is the other $800 coming from?
Exactly. Like, why did you voluntarily transfer $1,000 out of your bank account?
So what's the 800?
That $800 is the time value. It is the exorbitant, completely irrational markup you were willing to pay for the suspense, the hope, and the chance that this night is going to be magical.
You're paying for the anticipation.
Exactly. The possibility that she plays your favorite surprise song, the chance that you like lock eyes with the artist, the probability that this becomes a core memory. And think about it, the further away the concert is, say the show is 6 months from now, the more time you have to dream about how perfect it's going to be.
And the more that scalper can charge you for that dream.
Yes. So the $1,000 premium is equal to the $200 face value, the intrinsic value, plus the $800 hope and time you are paying for, which is the time value.
I love the psychology of that analogy because it perfectly separates the concrete reality from the speculative markup.
It makes it so much easier to visualize.
And in the Series 3, we are going to be dealing with traders who are making these exact types of speculative bets. Just, you know, not on pop stars, but on corn and gold and interest rates.
Right. So to make this stick in a way that isn't just dry textbook theory, we need to populate our market. We are going to introduce a recurring cast of characters today.
Let's do it.
I want you, the listener, to actually visualize these people, give them a face, because they are going to guide us through the math. First up, we have Call Buyer Carl.
Call Buyer Carl.
Got it. Picture Carl in this bright green jacket. He is the eternal optimist. He is always looking up, always assuming tomorrow is going to be a better, more expensive day. Carl buys calls because he wants things to climb. C for call, C for climb.
He is fundamentally bullish. He's stepping into the market and betting hard cash that the underlying futures price is going to rise.
Exactly. Then sitting across the desk from him, we have Put Buyer Penny.
Okay, Penny.
Penny is wearing red suspenders and has a permanent frown. She is our pessimist. She looks at the market and just sees a bubble waiting to burst.
She thinks it's all going to crash.
Right. She is always expecting the bottom to fall out. So Penny buys puts because she wants the market to plunge. P for put, P for plunge.
She is the bear. She is taking a position that only profits if the underlying futures price drops significantly.
Right. And finally, hovering above both of them, just watching, we have writer Wendy.
Wendy.
Wendy doesn't care about Carl's optimism or Penny's pessimism. She doesn't care if the market climbs or plunges. Wendy is the option seller.
In exam terminology, she would be the grantor or the writer.
Exactly. She is the scalper holding the concert ticket. Yeah. Wendy just sits in a lawn chair with a stopwatch and a pitcher of lemonade, collects the massive premiums up front from Carl and Penny, and watches the clock tick down.
She is playing the waiting game. Wendy is selling the hope. She is monetizing Carl and Penny's time value.
Yes.
And her entire goal in life is for time to run out before either of them can actually cash in on their bets.
So we have Carl wanting a climb, Penny wanting a plunge, and Wendy just watching the clock.
Perfect.
Let's look at how Carl and Penny actually realize any sort of return on their bets. And to do that, we have to start by dissecting the first half of our master equation.
We have to dive into intrinsic value.
Right, the right now reality.
So intrinsic value, or a FOR as you'll see it abbreviated on the exam, is the portion of the premium that is backed by real, hard, immediate worth.
The actual meat of it.
Yeah. If you stripped away all the hope, all the time, all the volatility, IV is what is left. The source material defines it very specifically. It is the gross financial advantage an option buyer would realize if they exercise the option at this exact specific instant.
The face value of the ticket.
Exactly. But we have to be incredibly careful here with our terminology because, you know, someone studying for the Series 3 might have some background in trading retail stock options, like buying options on Apple or Tesla.
Oh, yeah. This is way different.
Immensely different. When you trade equity options, the underlying is a share of corporate stock.
Right.
In the Series 3, we are strictly dealing with options on futures. So the underlying instrument isn't a share of a company, it is a futures contract.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. This means when we calculate intrinsic value, we are constantly comparing our locked-in option, the strike price, against the current fluctuating price of the underlying futures contract.
All right, let's put call buyer Carl in the hot seat and see how this works mechanically. Carl wants to figure out his intrinsic value today. How does he set up his math?
Well, we have to remind ourselves what a call option gives Carl the power to do. A call gives the buyer the right, but crucially, not the obligation to assume a long position in a futures contract at a specific predetermined price.
So that predetermined price is his strike price.
Yes. He locked in his buy-in price, and he wants the market to climb above that price.
Okay, because if the market climbs, the current futures price is now higher than his locked-in strike price, right?
Exactly. He has an advantage. So the formula for a call option's intrinsic value is simply the current underlying futures price minus the strike price.
Okay, let's run a scenario so you can actually see the numbers move.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say Carl is looking at a crude oil contract.
Okay, crude oil.
He buys a call option with a strike price of 100. That is his line in the sand. He has purchased the absolute right to go long to buy crude oil futures at 100. He goes to sleep, wakes up the next morning, and some major geopolitical news is broken. The open market for crude oil futures is now trading at 105. What is the concrete reality of Carl's situation right now?
Carl is in a phenomenal position. I mean, he holds a piece of paper that legally entitles him to buy something for $100 while the rest of the world has to pay $105 for it on the open market.
That's a great spot to be in.
It is. If he exercised his right at this exact second, he would instantly capture a 5-point advantage. We take the underlying futures price, $105, and subtract his strike price, $100.
$105 minus $100 equals 5.
Right. So Carl's call option has an intrinsic value of 5. And when an option has positive intrinsic value, we say it is in the money, or ITM.
The reality of the contract is working in his favor. Okay, but what about put buyer Penny? She is sitting at the same desk wearing her red suspenders, hoping the sky falls.
Penny requires us to flip our logic entirely. A put option gives Penny the right again, not the obligation to assume a short position in a futures contract at the strike price.
So she has locked in a guaranteed selling price.
Yes. And because she wants the market to plunge, her intrinsic value formula is the exact mirror image of Carl's.
Ah, the mirror image.
For a put, intrinsic value equals the strike price minus the underlying futures price.
Let's run her numbers.
Yeah.
Penny holds a put option with a strike price of 100. She has the right to go short to sell the market at 100.
Oh, okay.
The geopolitical news breaks, but this time it's a massive release of oil reserves. The market tanks, just like she predicted. The futures price drops to 95. What is the intrinsic value of her put?
Penny is thrilled. She has a guaranteed right to sell crude oil at 100, even though the current market is only willing to pay 95.
She has a massive advantage over the spot market.
Exactly. So we take her strike price, 100, and subtract the underlying futures price, 95.
100 minus 95 is 5.
Right. Penny's put also has an intrinsic value of 5. It is strongly in the money.
Okay. This all feels very clean when they are winning.
Mm-hmm.
But wait, stop right there. Let's flip the scenarios.
Oh.
Because testing scenarios where the trader is correct is not how the Series 3 tries to break you. We need to look at what happens when Carl and Penny are dead wrong.
Yeah, this is where the conceptual traps are buried.
Consider the trap a lot of test takers fall into here. Okay, listener, let's put you in call buyer Carl's shoes. You are the optimist. You bought a call with a strike price of 100. You need a climb.
You want it to go up.
But the market turns violently against you. A massive supply glut hits, and the underlying crude oil futures crash to 95. Take a second. What is your intrinsic value?
Instinctively, you run the formula we just talked about. Futures minus strike. 95 minus 100.
Right. Your brain, wanting to do the basic arithmetic, just screams out negative 5.
And if you bubble in an answer that involves negative 5 or you use negative 5 in a larger premium calculation, you have completely derailed the question. You just failed that question.
Wait, let's think about the reality of the contract. If I have the right to buy crude oil at 100, but I can just open my trading app and buy it on the open market for 95, why on earth would I exercise my option?
You would.
Right. I would be voluntarily choosing to lose 5 points. Mm. That makes zero economic sense. I just tear the contract up. So the value doesn't actually go negative, does it? It just stops. It hits a floor.
You've just deduced the floor of zero. This is a fundamental structural truth of what an option is. It is a right, a privilege, an alternative. It is not an obligation.
The futures contract is an obligation.
Right. With a future, you have to perform. But an option is a choice. And because the buyer will always act rationally and simply walk away from a bad deal, the option itself cannot have negative real-world value upon exercise.
So intrinsic value has a reinforced concrete floor of exactly zero.
Yes. So if you are in the exam and you write down 95 minus 100 and your pencil writes a negative sign, an alarm should go off in your head.
You immediately cross out the negative number and write a big fat zero.
Exactly. If the current market price makes exercising the option disadvantageous, we say the option is out of the money, or OTM, and the intrinsic value of any out of the money option is, by definition, zero.
Or if it's tied.
The same logic applies if the futures price is exactly tied with the strike price. Say the strike is 100 and the market is 100. That is called at the money, or ATM.
Okay, ATM.
There is no financial advantage to exercising it instead of just trading in the open market, so the intrinsic value is zero.
Let's bring this back to Penny real quick, just to make sure we have both sides of the mirror covered. Penny has a put strike at 100. She is betting on a plunge.
Right.
But a war breaks out, supply chains freeze, and the futures climb to 105. She has the right to sell at 100, but the market is handing out 105 to anyone who wants to sell.
So she is not going to exercise her put. She just ignores it.
Exactly. So her intrinsic value is zero, not negative five. Zero.
Yes. And analyzing Carl and Penny back to back like this brings us to another massive exam trap that the source material specifically highlights, It's what we call the mirror image trap.
Oh, this is a big one.
It is the single most flipped, most heavily confused fact in this entire unit, especially when the test clock is ticking down and anxiety is high.
Let's lay them out side by side explicitly so you can lock in the visual.
Think about Carl and Penny's mathematical needs. For Carl's call, intrinsic value equals futures minus strike, F minus K.
He needs the futures to be a larger number than his strike to get a positive result. He wants the market above him.
Right. Now, for Penny's put, intrinsic value equals strike minus futures, K minus F. She needs the futures to be a smaller number than her strike to get a positive result. She wants the market below her.
And because the brain is so accustomed to standard left-to-right math, test takers will constantly try to do futures minus strike for everything.
Oh, all the time.
If you catch yourself doing futures minus strike to calculate the intrinsic value for Penny's put, you have fallen into the trap. You have to lock in that they are mirror images. Call wants futures minus strike. Put wants strike minus futures. C for climb, P for plunge.
A fantastic, highly recommended strategy when you sit down for the exam is to use your scratch paper during the tutorial period.
Oh, brain dump.
Exactly. Before the clock even starts on question one, write those two formulas at the very top of your page. Call IV equals F minus K. Put IV equals K minus F. Just offload it from your working memory onto the paper so you don't flip them when you're fatigued on question 85.
That is a pro tip right there.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got intrinsic value locked down. It is the immediate, right now, payoff of the option, the concrete reality, and it can never, ever be negative.
Correct.
But hold on a second. I'm looking at a hypothetical options chain right now. Let's say I have a call with a strike of 100 and the futures are at 90. We just established that because it is out of the money, its intrinsic value is a hard zero.
Right. The face value is zero.
But the trading screen is showing a premium. It says the premium is 3 points. People are actively buying and selling this option for real money. If the intrinsic value is zero, why isn't the premium zero? What is Carl actually buying when he pays 3 points for a mathematical zero?
That is the multi-billion dollar question of the derivatives market. He is buying time value. Mm-hmm. He is buying the scalper's markup.
The melting ice cube of hope. Let's get into the second half of our master equation.
If we look back at our core identity, premium equals intrinsic value plus time value. If we just rearrange that algebraically, time value equals the premium minus the intrinsic value.
Okay, simple math.
Time value, which you will frequently hear referred to as extrinsic value by professional traders, is whatever the buyer is paying above and beyond the real world, right now intrinsic reality.
It's the $800 of anticipation for the Taylor Swift concert.
Exactly. It is purely the price of the waiting game. That premium markup is the market pricing in the volatility of the unknown.
So when Carl buys an out-of-the-money call, he isn't buying a guaranteed payout.
No, not at all. He is paying for the chance, the probability, that the underlying futures price will climb before the option legally expires. He is buying a runway of time.
I really want to emphasize the source materials analogy here because it is incredibly visual and it perfectly captures the agonizing dynamic between our buyers, Carl and Penny, and our seller, writer Wendy. The source compares time value to a physical block of ice.
It is the most accurate metaphor you can use.
Imagine that when Carl or Penny pays their premium, Wendy doesn't hand them a piece of paper. She hands them a literal freezing ice cube. That ice cube represents the time remaining until the expiration date.
Right. And what is the fundamental nature of an ice cube? If you just hold it in your hand, what happens?
It melts.
It melts. You don't have to do anything. The clock ticks, the sun shines, and every single day that passes, that ice cube gets a little bit smaller. A little bit of water drips through your fingers. The time value is constantly eroding.
In the options world, we call this time decay or theta decay.
And who is the biggest fan of time decay? Who is sitting on the sidelines cheering for the sun to shine?
Writer Wendy.
Writer Wendy, our option seller. Let's talk about her victory condition here. Wendy is the one who sold Carl that ice cube. She took his cold, hard cash on day one and handed him this block of hope. What is she doing for the next 30, 60, or 90 days of the contract life?
She is sitting in her lawn chair, sipping lemonade, rooting for nothing to happen. She wants that ice cube to melt completely away into a puddle on the pavement.
Because if the market doesn't move, if there is no dramatic climb or plunge, the option expires out of the money.
The intrinsic value is zero.
Right. And on expiration day, the time value has melted away to zero. Carl is left with wet hands and nothing else, and Wendy keeps every single dollar of the premium he paid her on day one.
It is vital to understand this dynamic for the exam. all else being equal, meaning if the underlying futures price just goes sideways and volatility doesn't change, the buyer loses time value every single day.
And the seller, the grantor, benefits from that exact same decay. It is a zero-sum game of time.
Which brings us to another massive specific exam trap. The test writers love to throw a scenario at you that takes place on the exact day of expiration.
The time decay trap. You have to remember the fundamental rule of the ice cube. At the exact moment the market closes on expiration day, the ice cube is entirely 100% gone.
Time value is exactly zero.
Therefore, at expiration, the equation simplifies. The premium equals the intrinsic value. Nothing more, nothing less.
Okay, listener, let's picture another Prometric exam question. The screen reads, you hold a call option with a strike price of 100. Today is the final day of trading before expiration. The underlying futures are currently trading at 104. Assuming no transaction costs, what is the value of this call option? Think of the ice cube. What is the answer?
It is exactly 4, just the pure intrinsic value. The futures are 104, your strike's 100. 104 minus 100 is 4.
And the trap here is that the multiple choice options are designed to second guess you. They might offer an answer like 4 plus the remaining implied time premium. Or they might try to give you some complicated Black-Scholes output.
Yeah, they want you to think, well, the day isn't over yet. Maybe there's a little bit of premium left.
Don't fall for it. For the purposes of the exam's expiration logic, there is no time left. There is no hope left. It is just the raw, concrete reality.
The ice cube has vanished. You are left holding whatever solid object was frozen inside of it. If it was out of the money, you are holding a zero. If it was in the money, you are holding the 4 points of intrinsic value.
Now, there's one more major trap in the time value realm, and we need to spend some serious time unpacking this because it is highly counterintuitive. We call it the moneyness mountain trap.
Yes, this one requires us to really think about the psychology of the market and how market makers price probability. Let's set up what the exam wants you to stumble on. They want to test your understanding of where time value is the highest.
Which specific options on the chain have the biggest, fattest ice cubes attached to them? Intuitively, a lot of people think, well, if I look at an option that is incredibly deep in the money, the premium is massive. If a call has a strike of 100 and the futures are at 200, the premium might be 105 points. So it must be packed with time value.
But that is the trap. Let's dissect that deep in the money option. Why is the premium 105 points?
It is huge because it is stuffed with 100 points of pure intrinsic value.
The concrete reality is dominating the price.
Exactly. The outcome of that option is basically settled history. Unless the market experiences a catastrophic, unprecedented crash in the next few weeks, that option is going to finish deeply in the money.
Right.
Because there is very little uncertainty about the final outcome. There's very little time value. The market doesn't need to charge a massive hope markup because the hope is already realized. The suspense is gone.
So if deep in the money options have low time value, and deep out of the money options are so far away that no one has any hope for them, where does the hope cost the most? Where is the ice cube the biggest? Time value is always greatest for at the money options. Options where the locked in strike price is exactly equal to or hovering right on top of the current underlying futures price.
Let's explain why this happens with a sports analogy, because I think this makes the market psychology instantly click. Imagine you are trying to buy tickets for a live, in-progress championship football game.
Okay, a football game.
When are the tickets on the secondary market going to command the absolute highest premium for the suspense of the game? Are you going to pay a fortune for a ticket in the middle of the fourth quarter when the home team is winning by 40 points?
No, the game is practically over. The outcome is settled. That is your deep-in-the-money scenario. The intrinsic value of the win is there, but there is zero suspense left.
Exactly. A blowout game has no drama. But what about a game that is tied 21-21 and there are exactly 2 minutes left on the clock in the fourth quarter?
Oh, that's peak heart-pounding suspense.
It is a 50-50 coin flip. Either team could win. The gambling interest, the excitement, the utter uncertainty of the outcome is at its absolute maximum. People will pay a ridiculous, exorbitant premium just to be inside the stadium for those final 2 minutes to see what happens.
That tied game is your at-the-money option. The strike price and the futures price are neck and neck. The market looks at it and says, this is a pure 50-50 probability on whether it finishes in the money or out of the money.
And because the uncertainty is at its absolute peak, the time value, the price the market charges for that suspense, is mathematically at its absolute highest.
So if we visualize this as the moneyness mountain, The peak of the mountain, the absolute highest altitude of time value, is always right in the middle, at the money.
Makes total sense.
As the option gets deeper and deeper in the money, it rolls down one side of the mountain and the time value shrinks. As it gets deeper and deeper out of the money, it rolls down the other side and the time value shrinks towards zero.
The exam application here is straightforward, but tricky. If a question asks which option out of a list likely has the greatest time value, do not just pick the option with the highest total premium. You must look for the strike price that is closest to the current underlying futures price. Find the tied game.
Find the tied game. I like that.
Okay, let's take a breath because we just built the entire foundational framework. We know exactly what a premium is made of. We have our core identity. Premium equals intrinsic value plus time value. We know Carl wants a climb, Penny wants a plunge, and Wendy just wants the ice cube to melt into nothing. We understand the right now reality, and we understand the markup for hope.
But here is where we have to introduce reality to the theory. The market is not a static textbook problem. We have calculated the right now reality. But the underlying futures price is a living, breathing thing. It is constantly moving.
Yeah, it ticks up, it ticks down, reacting to news, weather, algorithms all day long.
Right. And as that underlying price vibrates, our option premium has to react. It's connected by an invisible bungee cord.
Okay, so if I am Carl and the corn market climbs by one full point, does my call option premium also climb exactly one point? Does it climb half a point? Does it climb a quarter of a point? How fast does my premium react to the changing market? We need a sensitivity dial to measure the tension on that bungee cord.
And that introduces us to the most important Greek letter you need to know for the Series 3. Enter. The delta.
The delta. It sounds highly technical, but it is actually one of the most intensely practical tools a trader has. Let's define exactly what this sensitivity dial is measuring.
Delta measures the speed of the reaction. Very specifically, the source defines it as the ratio of how much an option's premium changes for a one-unit change in the underlying futures price.
Okay.
If the futures price moves by exactly one full point, the delta tells you exactly what fraction of a point your option premium is going to move in response.
So it's a speed limit. It tells me how fast my option is mirroring the market. Mm. But before we get into the math of the speed, we have to talk about the direction. And this is where the exam will try to absolutely destroy you if you aren't paying attention.
The sign matters trap.
Let's talk about the sign matters trap.
This is critical, and it goes back to our earlier discussion about the mirror image. Delta is not just a raw speed number. It is a vector. It has a mathematical sign attached to it, positive or negative. And that sign is dictated entirely by whether you are holding a call or a put.
Let's bring back Carl and Penny to visualize this. Call buyer Carl wants things to climb. When the underlying futures price climbs, when it moves in a positive direction, what happens to the value of Carl's call option?
His option becomes more valuable, the intrinsic value increases, so the overall premium increases.
Because the option premium moves in the exact same direction as the underlying futures price, call delta is mathematically positive. It runs on a scale from 0 to positive 1. If futures go up, Carl's premium goes up. It's a positive correlation.
Okay, now let's look at put buyer Penny. She wants a plunge. When the futures price climbs, when it goes in a positive direction, what happens to Penny's put option?
It becomes less valuable. Her dream is dying. She wants the market to drop. So if the market goes up, her option is bleeding intrinsic value. Her premium drops.
Because the option premium moves in the opposite direction of the underlying futures price, put delta is mathematically negative. It runs on a scale from 0 to -1.
Let me repeat that because it is an enormous psychological trap.
Mm-hmm.
Put delta is negative. Why is this such a brutal trap on an exam?
Because the human brain does not like dealing with inverse relationships intuitively, especially under time pressure. A very frequent exam trap will present a scenario where the futures price rises by 1 point. They will tell you a trader holds a put option with a delta magnitude of 0.5.
Right.
They want you to assume that because the market went up and the delta is 0.5, the put premium rises by 0.5.
It's the brain wanting to match a positive move with a positive result.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work that way.
Exactly. A put actually has a delta of negative 0.5. So if the market rises by a positive 1 point, you multiply 1 by negative 0.5 and the put premium falls by 0.5 points.
Only calls have positive delta. Puts move inversely to the underlying futures price. C for call, C for climb, positive. P for put, P for plunge, negative. You have to lock those mathematical signs into your brain before you do any calculations.
Now, once we understand the signs positive for calls, negative for puts, we need to map out how big the delta actually is. What is the actual speed limit? We said it ranges from 0 to 1 in absolute value, but where does a specific option sit within that range? It all comes back to the moneyness mountain we just climbed.
Let's do a delta by moneyness mapping. We need to look at how the market maker assigns probabilities. Let's start with an option that is deep in the money, a call option where the strike is 100 and the futures have skyrocketed to 200. It's deep, deep in the money. What is the delta, the speed limit of that option?
It approaches a perfect 1 for a call or a negative 1 for a put. Why? Because we established earlier that a deep in the money option is almost entirely intrinsic value. It is essentially behaving exactly like the underlying futures contract itself.
So if the futures price moves 1 point, the intrinsic value moves exactly 1 point. So the premium moves almost exactly 1 point. The bungee cord is pulled totally taut. It is a 1-for-1 relationship.
Okay, what about our tied football game? The at the money option. Strike is 100, futures are at 100, the tension is at its peak.
We established that an at the money option is a 50-50 coin flip. The market maker's pricing model basically says there's a 50% chance this finishes in the money and a 50% chance it finishes completely worthless.
Therefore, the market prices its sensitivity at exactly that probability. An at the money option has a delta of roughly 0.5 for a call or negative 0.5 for a put. If the futures move 1 point, the premium only moves half a point because the market is only 50% sure it matters.
And finally, deep out of the money. Strike is 100, but the futures have crashed to 10. You need an absolute miracle to get back in the money.
The probability of success is near zero, so the delta approaches zero. It barely reacts to price moves at all. If the market ticks up 1 point from 10 to 11, your call at 100 is still so hopelessly far away that the market doesn't care.
The premium isn't gonna budge. The speed limit is effectively zero.
Okay, I want to push back on something here. This mapping is fascinating, and I get how it helps a day trader sitting at a terminal calculating exactly how fast their premium is making or losing money tick by tick. But I hear all the time that delta isn't just a speedometer. It is used as a massive defensive tool by commercial firms. People talk about delta hedging portfolios. How does knowing the speed of my option actually help me protect a physical commodity or a massive financial position?
That is the perfect question to bridge the gap between theory and real-world application. Delta is not just a sensitivity dial. It has a second, highly testable, incredibly vital function on the Series 3. Delta operates as the dynamic hedge ratio.
The dynamic hedge ratio. Let's break that phrase down. What does that actually mean in practice?
Think about what a hedge actually is. It is a deliberate action taken to offset directional risk. If you are a massive wheat farmer, you are naturally long on wheat. If the price of wheat drops, your farm loses money. To protect yourself, you might buy put options on wheat futures so that if the market drops, your options make money, offsetting your farm's losses.
But the problem is options don't move at the same speed as the physical wheat or the underlying futures contract.
Exactly. A futures contract moves point for point with the market. But we just learned that options move at fractions of a point, dictated by their delta. The hedge ratio tells you exactly how many of these slower moving options you need to buy to perfectly balance out your fast moving underlying exposure.
And delta is the conversion rate.
Yes. Here is the golden rule of hedging with options. Delta approximates how many futures contracts a single option position behaves like.
Let's do the math on this step by step because this is guaranteed to be tested. Let's establish our baseline. One underlying futures contract, just raw futures, has a delta of exactly 1. It moves 1-for-1 with itself.
Correct. Now, let's say our wheat farmer wants to hedge using at-the-money put options. We just learned that an at-the-money option has a delta magnitude of roughly 0.5.
Okay, so that single option only has half the speed, half the sensitivity of a full futures contract. It behaves like exactly half of a futures contract.
Right, so let's frame a scenario for you. If you have options with a 0.5 delta, and you want to mathematically completely offset the price movement of one full futures contract, which has a delta of 1-1, how many of those 0.5 delta options do you need to buy? Take a second.
Well, if each one is doing half the work, you need 2-0 of them.
Exactly. Two options, each contributing a delta of 0.5, give you a combined delta of 1. You line up two options on one side of the scale to perfectly balance out the one futures contract on the other side. That 2-to-1 relationship is your hedge ratio.
It's exactly like an exchange rate. If one U.S. dollar is worth 2 of some foreign currency, you need to hand over 2 foreign bills to buy a $1 item. The delta is the active exchange rate between the sluggish option and the fast-moving futures contract.
But here is where we hit what I call the dynamic trap. And this is a huge conceptual hurdle that trips up a lot of people who think of hedging as buying insurance. The key word in this entire concept is dynamic.
Why is it dynamic? Why can't I just buy my two options and go sleep easy?
Let's walk through a timeline. Let's say our farmer establishes that 2-to-1 hedge in May. The options are at the money. Delta is 0.5. He feels perfectly protected. But in June, the bottom falls out of the wheat market. The price drops significantly. What happens to his put options?
Well, because the market plunged, his puts are now making money. They move from at the money to being in the money.
And what happens to the delta of an option as it moves deeper in the money?
Ooh, times. The speed limit increases. It moves from 0.5 up towards 1.0.
Precisely. The underlying price moved, which changed the moneyness, which changed the delta. The sensitivity dial turned itself up as the option gained intrinsic value. Because the delta shifted, his carefully calculated hedge ratio just broke. He no longer needs two options to hedge one future, because now each option is behaving more like a full future on its own.
His exchange rate just reset in real time. If he holds on to both of those options now that their delta is approaching one, he is actually overhedged. He has accidentally become a speculator on the downside.
Yes. The hedge ratio is a constantly moving target. It is intensely dynamic. The exam trick here is that they will give you a multiple choice answer that treats the hedge ratio as a locked in, set it and forget it insurance policy for the life of the trade. If you see an answer that says establish a hedge ratio of 2-to-1 and hold it until expiration, it is almost guaranteed to be wrong in a dynamic hedging scenario. As the market moves, delta drifts, and the hedger has to constantly buy or sell options to adjust the ratio and stay neutral.
But wait, if I have to constantly adjust my hedge, buying and selling options every week as the market vibrates, isn't that incredibly expensive? Am I just eating transaction fees and bid-ask spreads all day?
You are touching on a very real friction in the market. Yes, dynamic hedging, or delta neutral hedging, is expensive to maintain. That is why you typically see massive commercial firms, investment banks, and market makers running these dynamic hedges algorithms rather than individual retail farmers. But for the exam, you must understand the theory. Delta is dynamic, moving, shifting. Lock that word in.
Okay, we have covered a staggering amount of ground. We've calculated the intrinsic value, the hard reality. We watched the time value melt away like an ice cube over time, and we used delta to figure out exactly how fast the premium moves and how many options we need to build a protective shield.
We know exactly how many points this premium should be worth mathematically. But here is the crazy part, and where a lot of the real-world disasters happen. When you sit down at a trading terminal, or when you are looking at a complex exam scenario, and you look at the, quote, screen to actually buy the option, the number staring back at you does not look like dollars and cents.
No, it doesn't. And if you try to treat it like a dollar amount, you are going to fail the question instantly, or in the real world, you are going to blow up your account. We have to understand premium quotations. I call this translating the arcade tokens.
It is a perfect analogy because it explains the absolute absurdity of how these things are priced on the screen. Let's define the structural concept first. According to the exchanges, options on futures premiums borrow the price language of the underlying contract they sit on. They are quoted in the price points and the fractional minimum ticks of the underlying futures contract. They are not quoted in raw U.S. dollars.
Right. So you might look at a trading screen and see a premium quote as simply as 2.00, but that does not mean $2. It is an arbitrary unit of measurement based entirely on the specific commodity or financial instrument you are trading.
Which is where your Dave and Buster's analogy comes in.
Yes. Imagine you are at a massive arcade. You spend an hour playing skee ball, you do pretty well, you get a massive reel of physical tickets, and you walk up to the prize counter. You see a giant stuffed bear, and the price tag says 2,000 tickets.
Okay, a premium quote of 2,000 tickets.
Exactly. But you want to know, how much is that bear actually worth in real-world U.S. dollars? You can't just look at the tag and say it's worth $2,000. That's insane. And you can't say it's worth $2. The number on the tag is useless until you figure out the exchange rate of the arcade. How much real cash did you have to put into the skee ball machine to win one single ticket?
You need to know the inherent value of the token.
You have to look at the arcade's specific mandated exchange rate. And in the futures market, that exchange rate is called the point value, or the contract multiplier.
Exactly. To convert that quoted arbitrary premium on the screen into actual spendable dollars leaving your account, it requires one mandatory step of multiplication. The true dollar cost equals the quoted premium multiplied by the contract's point value.
The multiplier. And who decides what this multiplier is? Is it set by the market?
No, it is hard-coded by the exchange itself. The CME, the CBOT, the NYMEX, they set it when they create the contract. It represents the dollar amount of a one-point move in that specific futures contract. It is baked into the contract specifications to standardize trading.
And this is where we have to be incredibly careful, because the logistics of these markets vary wildly. You cannot just memorize one magic multiplier for the exam.
Absolutely not. Do not try to memorize a single universal point value. The multiplier varies by contract because the physical realities of the commodities vary. A one-point move in a 5,000 bushel corn contract has a completely different financial impact than a one-point move in a massive S&P 500 index contract. The exam will typically give you the multiplier in the text of the question, or you will be expected to know the basic specs for the major benchmark contracts. But the mathematical mechanic multiplying the quote by the value is always identical.
Let's do a side-by-side example to show how much this matters and how someone could blow up their account if they ignore it. Let's say call buyer Carl is looking at two different options on two totally different futures contracts. Both of them are quoted on his screen at a premium of exactly 2.000 points. Let's look at contract A first. Contract A is a standard grain contract, and its multiplier, its point value, is $50 per point. What is the real dollar cost for Carl to buy this option?
Simple arithmetic. You take the screen quote of $2, multiply by the $50 point value, and the real dollar cost to enter the trade is $100.
Okay, manageable. Now let's look at contract B. It also has a quote of 2.0 points staring at him on the screen. But contract B is a massive financial index contract, and its multiplier is $250 per point. What does this one cost?
You take the exact same $2 quote, multiply it by the $250 multiplier, and the actual cost to Carl is $500.
The exact same quote on the screen. Radically different amounts of money leaving Carl's bank account. This is why you cannot ignore the multiplier. You are reading a price tag written in a foreign currency, and you must run it through the exchange rate before you pull out your wallet.
And this leads directly to the final and perhaps most successfully devious exam trap in this section, the raw quote trap.
Call it out, because this one makes me so angry.
The source material warns us explicitly about this. The test writers know that under time pressure, your brain wants to take shortcuts. If an exam question says the premium is quoted at $2.07 and it asks for the dollar cost of the option, they're going to bait the trap. One of the multiple choice answers will literally just be $2. Another might be $20.
If you see a multiple choice answer that is just the raw quote from the prompt with a dollar sign slapped in front of it, what do?
You aggressively cross it out. Do not even entertain it. That choice deliberately skipped the conversion entirely. It assumed the arcade tickets were US dollars. Always, always, always multiply the quote by the contract's point value before you even look at the multiple choice options.
It is such a cheap psychological trick, but they catch so many people with it because you are stressed, you are rushing, you see 2.00 in the text and $2 in option A, and your brain just wants the dopamine hit of matching the numbers and moving on to the next question. Do not let them steal a point from you on something so mechanical. Multiply the quote by the point value. End of story.
It requires discipline. It's a mechanical step, but you have to force yourself to execute the mechanic every single time you see a quote.
Okay. We've thoroughly ripped this topic apart. We have gone from the theoretical psychology of the scalper all the way down to the nitty-gritty math of the arcade tokens. Let's pull all of this together and run a rapid-fire synthesis of the unbreakable rules we've established today. I'll tee up the concept. You give me the absolute bottom-line takeaway the listener needs to burn into their brain before they walk into the testing center.
Let's lock it in.
The master equation, the core identity of every option premium on Earth.
Premium equals intrinsic value plus time value. It is the concrete, right now reality, plus the speculative, melting hope.
The floor of intrinsic value. When Carl is dead wrong and the market turns against him, how low can his intrinsic value go?
It stops at zero. Intrinsic value can never be negative. If an option is out of the money, its intrinsic value is exactly zero. You would never exercise a right that forces you to lose money. You just walk away.
The mirror image trap. Keeping our character straight, how do we calculate intrinsic value without flipping the signs?
Call buyer Carl wants futures to climb, so his formula is futures minus strike. Put buyer Penny wants futures to plunge, so her formula is strike minus futures. Lock the C for climb and P for plunge into your scratch paper immediately.
The moneyness mountain. Where is the scalper's markup, the time value, at its absolute peak?
Time value is highest at the money, where uncertainty is a pure 50-50 coin flip. It is not deep in the money, where the suspense is already over. And remember, that time value decays to exactly zero by the close of expiration day.
Delta sign, the direction of the sensitivity dial.
Call delta is mathematically positive because the option's value moves with the market. put delta as mathematically negative because the option's value moves inversely to the market. Beware the trap of trying to add a positive number to a put premium when the market rises.
Hedging with delta. If our wheat farmer builds a hedge ratio using delta, can he just set it and forget it?
Absolutely not. Delta provides a dynamic hedge ratio. As the market price vibrates, the moneyness changes, the delta shifts, and the hedger must actively adjust the number of options they hold to stay balanced against their underlying futures position.
And finally, the arcade token. What must you do the second you see a premium quote on the screen or in a question?
A premium quote is not a dollar amount. You must multiply the raw quote by the specific contract's point value, its multiplier, to calculate the real dollar cost. Never choose an answer that just slaps a dollar sign on the raw quote.
Boom! That is the Series 3 Options Premium Unit completely decoded. If you can internalize those rules and understand the why behind them that we've discussed today, you are going to absolutely crush this section of the exam.
It really is about understanding the mechanics, not just memorizing the formulas. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought. Something to mull over as you run your practice exams. Something that builds on what we've talked about but wasn't explicitly spelled out in today's source material.
Oh, I love this. A little extra credit for the deep thinkers trying to understand market structure. Lay it on us.
We have spent a tremendous amount of time today talking about how delta changes as the price of the underlying market moves. We said that as the market moves from at the money to in the money, the delta climbs from 0.5 to 1. The price moves, so the delta shifts. But think about the other side of our core equation. Think about time value. We know that the ice cube of time value melts every single day.
Right. Theta decay. The clock is always ticking.
So if time is constantly vanishing, how do you think time itself impacts delta?
Let's take our at-the-money option, our tied football game. We establish it's a 50-50 coin flip with a delta of exactly 0.5. But does that 50-50 coin flip feel the same to the market with 30 days left on the clock versus 30 seconds left on the clock?
Oh, wow. No, it absolutely doesn't. With 30 days left, the market has time to breathe. Anything can happen. It could swing wildly in both directions. But with 30 seconds left, a single fractional tick of the market decides the entire financial fate of the option. The tension is infinitely higher. Exactly. So think about how the speed of that delta shift, the acceleration of the dial, might change as the clock runs out. As time vanishes, an option has to make a final, violent decision about whether it is going to finish at a delta of 1, meaning it's in the money, or a delta of 0, meaning it's worthless. It cannot stay at 0.5 forever. How does the vanishing of time force that sensitivity dial to whip back and forth faster and faster? In options theory, this acceleration is called gamma. But just contemplating how the vanishing ice cube forces delta to make a choice is a fascinating dynamic to explore as you get deeper into the psychology of the market.
But that is going to keep some people awake tonight. The speed of the speed dial changing as time runs out, that is genuinely mind-bending, and it explains why expiration day trading gets so incredibly volatile.
You have your mission, you have your characters, you have the unbreakable rules. Go hit those cert fuel practice exams, run the reps, and don't let them trick you with a negative intrinsic value or a raw dollar quote. You know the mechanics now. Keep climbing, keep studying, and we will see you on the next deep dive.